Okay, so we are in Deuteronomy 25, and today finishing this portion of all those detailed laws, and there then is another section to come that moves fairly quickly through things. So we begin in 25 verse 1, if there is a dispute between men and they come into court and the judges decide between them, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty, and
you're lucky. It's
going to get unpleasant. Verse 2.
If the guilty man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall make him lie down and have him flogged in his presence with the number of lashes his crime deserves.
Okay. 40 stripes may be given him, but not more, lest if one should go on to beat him with more stripes than these, your brother be degraded in your sight. I think Dalich might have a few things to say. And that he may not become Bin Hakot, son of stripes, meaning a man liable to stripes and beatings and death. 40 stripes and not more. Now the details. The strokes were administered with a stick upon the back. This was the Egyptian mode of whipping, depicted upon the monuments when the culprits lie flat upon the ground and being held fast by the hands and feet, receive their strokes in the presence of the judge. A larger number of strokes with a stick would not only endanger health and life, but disgrace the man. In Turkey, the punishments inflicted are much more severe, from 50 to 100 lashes with a whip, and they are at the same time inhuman. 40 was probably chosen with reference to its symbolical significance, which it had derived from Genesis 7 onwards. And that was what happened in Genesis 7. 40 days and 40 nights.
Oh.
Yeah. The rabbis fixed the number at 40 save one. So the 30 lashes are the 40 minus one lashes in case a mistake should be made in the counting. Yet they felt no conscientious scruples about using a whip of twisted thongs instead of a stick. So, now you know more about whipping than you wanted.
Deuteronomy.
Verse 4.
You shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain.
Okay. What does that mean?
What group is it to talk about paying pastors?
25.
And Dalich says it is not intended to apply merely literally to an ox, but to be understood in the general sense in which the Apostle Paul uses it in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 9, and 1 Timothy 5, verse 18. Which he applies generally and openly to the worker is worthy of his wages. If the ox is treading the grain, the ox should not be muzzled. So yeah, one comment. If I want my wages to be respected and counted worthy, then I must respect and count worthy others' wages. And if I hire somebody to work at my house and they say, oh, you're a pastor, we'll just do it for free, I have problems with that, because the worker is worthy of his wages. And the respect for work is something that is a good and healthy thing. Work is to be honored, which in fact, then to go a bunch of steps further, is why the Union Army won the war. Because in the South, work was disrespected. The owner of the slave felt he was above work. The slave did his work but got none of the benefits. And so work was disrespected all the way around. And who was the Frenchman that went traveling through the United States and sat looking, comparing Ohio and Kentucky, one a slave state, one a free state, and found that in the free state, there was enterprise and diligence and all kinds of things were happening. And in the free state then, the whole idea of work was respected and everybody thrived and it was prosperous, while in the slave state, nothing was prosperous. Because if you disrespect work, then you are dooming yourself. Okay, that's my rant. Shall we go on? If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Alexis de Tocqueville was the Frenchman. Paula just looked it up. And this is not simply for sons, male children. If there was a daughter, the line was carried on through her, as her husband would then become the inheritor of the family's property and the family's name. Delitzsch details that from other passages. Verse 6.
First son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel.
Mm-hmm. And then let's get unpleasant. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then the brother's wife shall go up to the gate of the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Okay, verse 8.
Then the elders of his town shall summon him and talk to him. If he persists in saying, I do not want to marry her.
Ready to be entertained? Then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. What? Verse 10.
That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled.
The family of the unsandaled.
Okay. That must mean something.
Yep. Let's see. Moses recognized the custom as justifiable within limits. He took away the compulsory character, so that if the surviving brother refused to marry his widowed sister-in-law, she was to bring the matter to the elders. And then the taking the shoe or the sandal off the foot. The taking off of the shoe was an ancient custom in Israel adopted according to Ruth 4 verse 7 in cases of redemption and exchange for the purpose of confirming commercial transactions. The usage arose from the fact that when anyone took possession of landed property, he did so by treading upon the soil and asserting his right of possession by standing upon it in his shoes. In this way, the taking off of the shoe and handing it to another became a symbol of the renunciation of a man's position and property, a symbol which was also common among the Indians and ancient Germans. Really? But the custom was an ignominious one in such a case as this, when the shoe was publicly taken off the foot of the brother-in-law by the widow whom he refused to marry. He was thus deprived of the position which he ought to have occupied in relation to her and to his deceased brother or to his paternal house. And the disgrace involved in this was still further heightened by the fact that his sister-in-law spat in his face. There's more. This is not merely spitting on the ground before his eyes. In addition to this, the unwilling brother-in-law was to receive a name of ridicule in Israel. House of the shoe taken off. It was only in miserable circumstances that the Hebrews went barefoot. If the brother-in-law bore this reproach upon himself and his house, he was released from his duty as a brother-in-law. By these regulations, the brother-in-law's marriage was recognized as a duty of affection toward his deceased brother, but not made a command. And neglecting it would not bring punishment and guilt and being beaten with sticks.
So he gets to keep all the property and she doesn't get anything then from her dead husband.
Not entirely sure how that would play out.
What if there are multiple brothers? Does it follow from the eldest down, or could one of them volunteer?
I'm guessing that could be arranged informally, but the one to whom it fell first, he'd be the one that was put to shame, and it could go to the next one, the next one, the next one, and the whole family put to shame.
What if he's already married?
Well, yeah. Then he has to do his duty to a second woman. Yeah. This is what causes this? Sin and death. So the whole point was to keep the man's line going. You just have to go, okay, shall we keep on reading?
Yeah.
House of the shoe pulled off. What was it, Deb, you read? House of the unsandaled?
Yeah, family of the unsandaled.
More accurate might be house of the desandaled. Okay. Let's get more disturbing. More disturbing now. Ready for more disturbing?
Bring it.
When men fight with one another and the wife of the one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who is beating him and puts out her hand and seizes him, the one doing the beating, seizes him by the private parts.
Man.
She's seizing her husband or the assailant?
The other guy.
Assailant.
Oh, okay.
Then you get to read verse 12.
You shall cut off her hand. Show no pity. Oh, my goodness.
We are a disturbing species.
Yes, we are.
I have no further comment.
Oh, goodness.
You shall have in your you shall not have in your bag two kinds of weights, a large and a small. What? Okay, verse 14.
Do not have two different measures in your house, one large, one small.
Mm-hmm. A full and fair weight you shall have, a full and fair measure you shall have, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. 16.
For all who do such things, who act dishonestly, are an abomination to the Lord your God.
And you, of course, do remember the story of the woman who went to the butcher, said she had friends coming for dinner and she needed a nice chicken. And so he takes out a chicken, puts it on the scale, weighs it out, tells her what it is. She says, no, that's not enough. So he takes the chicken down from the scale, puts it back, takes the same chicken out, puts it on the scale, and leaves his thumb on the scale. And now it weighs, you know, significantly more. And she says, good, that's good. I'll take both.
Smart woman.
Dishonest butcher.
Okay. The chicken and his thumb. Yeah, no.
Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt. Amalek. Here we get to Amalek again. What did Amalek do? Remind them of the crafty enemy Amalek on their march out of Egypt. This heathen nation had come against Israel on its journey at Rephidim in Horeb and had attacked his rear. Yeah. Verse 18.
When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey and cut off all who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God.
Mm-hmm. So those who were lagging behind, which would be what? The elderly, the weary, maybe some of the children who couldn't keep up in the march. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under the heaven. You shall not forget. Okay, Dalich takes us to 1 Samuel 15. And, 1 Samuel 15, doing some summarizing through here. Saul summoned the people, verse 4, numbered them. Verse 5, came to the city of Amalek and lay in wait in the valley. said to the Kenites, go, depart, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the people of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. Verse 7, and Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt. And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fattened calves and the lambs and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless they devoted to destruction. And Samuel is upset. God is upset. They were told to erase the memory of Amalek. And verse 22, and Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices and as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice. Verse 23, rebellion is as the sin of divination. Yeah. Presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. And then Samuel has Agag brought to him and strikes him with the sword. Samuel hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. So that's when it is carried out. And there's no more of Amalek anymore. Where are we? And that's the end of chapter 25. There is one more chapter in this recitation of different laws. And then we move into a different section. Chapter 26. When you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance and have taken possession of it and live in it, this is a very positive cap on the whole thing. Verse 2.
Take some of the first fruits of all that you produce from the soil of the land the Lord your God is giving you and put them in a basket. Then go to the place the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name.
Okay. Basket, basket, basket. Basket of wicker work. Okay. Verse 3. And you shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, oh, by the way, that is the priest, not the high priest, but the priest on duty, who's assigned to receive sacrifices and freewill offerings and tithes. But you shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come into the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. So this is actually a confession of acknowledging the acts of God. Verse 4.
The priest shall take the basket from your hands and set it down in front of the altar of the Lord your God.
Okay. So the basket is the physical representation, the proof of the faithfulness of God. The words are the confession of the faithfulness of God. Verse 7, and you shall make response before the Lord your God. This is going to get somewhat detailed. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation great and mighty and prosperous. So the wandering Aramean apparently is a reference to Jacob, because of the time he spent in Aram. Also, wandering, oved, signifies not only going astray or wandering, but in danger of perishing. And the words used that way both in Job and in Proverbs. Jacob is referred to, who at the time when he went down to Egypt, there was the famine in the land. He had wandered. He had gone back and worked under Laban for 20 years and then came back. And so there's huge amounts of history simply packed into a wandering Aramean. But to be precise, very often when we hear that, we think Abraham. And the reference actually is to Jacob. So, verse 6.
But the Egyptians mistreated us and made us suffer, putting us to hard labor.
Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. Verse 8.
And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great deeds of terror, with signs and wonders.
And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Verse 10.
And now I bring the first fruits of the soil that you, O Lord, have given me. Place the basket before the Lord, your God, and bow down before him.
Mm-hmm. And different translation, worship before the Lord, your God. So, a confession of the great acts of God and of the blessings of God. And yes, very, very, very appropriate as an acknowledgement of the goodness of God and of the grace and the blessings. And again, the basket and the first fruits are the objects and the proof. The words are the confession. And then verse 11, and you shall rejoice in all the good that the Lord your God has given to you and to your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you. See how the blessings spread out? That is part one of chapter 26 and has to do with the first fruits. There's a shift now to something else. Verse 12.
When you have finished setting aside a tenth of all your produce in the third year, the year of the tithe, you shall give it to the Levite, the alien, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat in your towns and be satisfied.
Okay. So this is something we we read through before, that the tithe on the third year and on the sixth year was dedicated in certain ways. The third year tithe was for those who had difficulty making ends meet, or those who were poor, or those who had no means. The Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow. Verse 13, then you shall say before the Lord your God, and this is a confession that you have done according to the law, and that you have not taken some of it for yourself. You shall say before the Lord your God, I have removed the sacred portion out of my house, and moreover, I have given it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandment that you have commanded me. I have not transgressed any of your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. The sacred portion is that which is sanctified. And sanctification, once again, in the Old Testament perspective of things, is set apart for God's use. It is removed from you having a right to it. It belongs to God. There's, by the way, an old tradition that if you're in church doing this or doing that and you drop a coin on the floor, who does it belong to? Recently, I dropped a penny. Deb might remember having had to count that penny.
Yes, and there was also a dime.
Yeah.
2 weeks in a row, there were like weird coins. And so Barb and I were wondering about that.
Yeah. Somebody drops a coin on the floor. Oh, that belongs to God.
Yep.
And that is long tradition in churches.
But if you drop your wallet. No.
Stop, that doesn't get our clumsiness. No.
But it's just a recognition that all came from him, and it's an act of worship. And I remember reading that, I don't know how many different places, but I can tell you that goes back centuries.
Never heard that before.
Really?
I'll have to remember that.
Okay. Let's see the secret verse 14.
You shall not have in your house two kinds of men. I'm in the wrong chapter. Sorry.
Way wrong.
No, I just flipped there. I forgot to flip the page. Away and then forget where you were. Okay, I have not eaten of the tithe while I was mourning, or removed any of it while I was unclean, or offered any of it to the dead. I have obeyed the voice of my God. I have done according to all that you have commanded me.
Of the Lord my God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Delich, we need Delich. Not given any of most probably refers to the custom of sending provisions into a house of mourning to prepare meals for the mourners. A house of mourning with its inhabitants was regarded as unclean. Consequently, nothing could be carried into it of that which was sanctified. There is no good grounds for thinking of idolatrous customs. Okay. So our translation may be pushing a little bit far. Verse 15, look down from your holy habitation from heaven and bless your people Israel and the ground that you have given us as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now the recognition there is, as we do according to God's will and care for the poor among us, then God cares for us in the blessing of the land and the produce and everything else. But if we start withholding, God can easily withhold the rain. Mm-hmm. He can easily withhold that portion of the crop that we decided was ours anyway. He can withhold much more by the accidents, quote, of nature, by the accidents of wear and tear on things, then we can make up by dipping into what belongs to him. And I used to use the line, you know how old my car is? Why has it not broken down yet? Things like that. There are numerous ways that God can restore a blessing to us when we have given in showing generosity to people that he commands us to take care of. Numerous ways that he can return that to us. Does any of us know for certain when the car or the refrigerator or the air conditioning or whatnot is going to break down? And if God prolongs the life of those things, then that can be far more than we have given away. And, you know, living with that in mind is a confession of faith.
Yep, the refrigerator that we lived in three states with.
Yeah, we got it 1986, was 87, it?
87, when your 87. Mom moved into her new house.
It was used. It was found in the house that they moved into. So they said, we don't have any use for it. Here, take it. So we hauled it to Iowa. Then we hauled it to Wisconsin. Then we hauled it to Southern Illinois. And when we left there in 2013, we left the refrigerator there, still working.
But it broke down once. And the repairman said, it's under warranty. And fix the compressor. Remember?
No, I don't remember.
That was Dave Bargman.
Oh, that was years and years later. It was still under warranty.
It was still under warranty, and he fixed the compressor, or it was recalled. It was
what warranty lasts that long anymore?
I don't know if it was a warranty or recall. I think it might have been a recall.
Ours broke down, and Art Turner gave us one of his that was in his garage. Mike, how long ago was that now?
I don't remember.
It's still running. Mm-hmm. It's still running. We're like, if it ain't broke, we ain't buying a new one.
Right. Okay.
So, blessings.
Verse 16.
The Lord your God commands you this day to follow these decrees and laws. Carefully observe them with all your heart and with all your soul.
Does this sound like he's beginning to wrap up this portion?
Sounds like it.
Okay. Verse 17, you have declared today that the Lord is your God and that you will walk in his ways and keep his statutes and his commandments and his rules and will obey his voice. Dalich has some comments on that. Verse 17, it's a declaration that the nation would accept the Lord as its God and walk in his ways. It is, the giving of the law on the part of God was a practical confirmation of his promise that Israel should be his people. And then I did look this up. Deuteronomy 26, verse 17. Not that page. Observe his laws and commandments and rules. And these are chukkal, the mitzvotau, the mishpatau. The mitzvot and the mishpat are deep covenant words. The one is the teachings, regulations and teachings, and the other is the commandments. Commandments being revelations. and all of his commandments. So this is taking you back to the Ten Commandments, and it's journeying back, going backwards, 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 getting back to things of Mount Sinai in verse 17. And then verse 18, somebody?
And the Lord has declared today that you are a people for his treasured possession, as he has promised you, and that you are to keep all his commandments.
Okay, if you don't remember this, the commandments are Exodus 20. The treasured possession language is Exodus 19, the previous chapter. In Exodus 19, they arrived at Sinai, and God called Moses up on the mountain and said, if you will hear my voice and obey my commandments, then you will be to me a treasured possession and a treasured inheritance, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, because all the earth is mine, and I have called you to be my people. And that's Exodus 19, verses 4, 5, and 6. So going right back to the beginning of the encounter on Mount Sinai, of the people's encounter on Mount Sinai. And then verse 19, and that he will set you in praise and in fame and in high honor, honor high above all nations that he has made, and that you shall be a people holy to the Lord your God, as he promised. Okay.
Was all this, all these commandments and laws and all this talking to the people, this was all done in one day before they entered the land?
This whole section that we have been through for the last couple of months is Moses's discourse. And this is pretty much all in one day.
Wow.
The entire discourse.
And is he talking to all the people?
He called them all to be there.
Wow, he must have. I mean, there was a lot of people.
Yeah. And he's making himself heard, and he's how old?
I don't know.
40 years in Egypt, 40 years in watching the sheep, 40 years bringing the people out of Egypt into the promised land.
120?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Evidently, God gave him the ability to project his voice out over all these people.
Yeah. Well,
there are some kind of natural formations that make great amphitheaters, too.
Yeah.
But
stand up against a mountain. And it.
How many chapters has he gone through?
Yeah, quite a few.
This is not done without strength from God. So be useful to God and be blessed.
Right.
Yeah. That's my retirement plan. Be useful to God and he will give strength. Now there is a end of section there. And a huge transition going into the next chapter. And they're talking about in the next chapter, renewing the covenant and then what to do to confirm the covenant when they get into the promised land. All of which is, you know, quite interesting. And then in chapter 28, it is blessings and curses. So shall we begin on 27? Now Moses and the elders of Israel, we've transitioned, haven't we? This is whole new territory in the book. Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, keep the whole commandment that I command you today. Verse 2.
And on the day you cross over the Jordan to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall set up large stones and plaster them with plaster.
Okay.
Plaster them with plaster.
And the discussion goes on in the commentaries because they do not know. They're scholars. They don't know these things. Is it plaster or is it lime? Is it gypsum or is it lime? The answer is, don't you know you make a special mix for different purposes? And so it is a gypsum and lime mixture. The gypsum to produce the hardness and the lime to produce the stickiness. The lime also, you know, if something gets wet, the lime will reconstitute itself within the gypsum and that will preserve it for much longer. Our house has two layers of stucco on it. There's new technology stucco that is a hard shell. It cracks. There is old technology stucco underneath it, which is a mixture of, there's some aggregate, there's some gypsum, and there's a whole lot of lime. And the reason for the whole lot of lime is if it cracks and if water gets into the crack, the lime will dissolve and then the lime will reset. And it's actually known as a self-sealing stucco. So when they stuccoed over that, it's going to crack. There's going to be, when it rains, there will be water that seeps through and hits the lime layer. And when it hits that layer, the lime will dissolve and then reset and seal up whatever leak there is. It's a pretty nice system having the old and the new technology sistered together. So this is something that the people of Israel would have known because they did all of the all of the craftsmanship, all of the skilled workmanship in Egypt before they walked out. And that's part of why Pharaoh says, what have we done? Who's going to repair such and such? And when such and such breaks down, none of us know what to do because we had the Israelites do all of that for us. That's my take on it. So, large stones and plastered with plaster, verse 3. And you shall write on them all the words of this law when you cross over to enter the land that the Lord your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you. What is it, all the words of this law?
The Ten Commandments?
Yeah.
Or the whole thing that he just shared.
And Dalich raises the possibility of, is it all of the 613 commandments in the Pentateuch, the first five books, the you shall and you shall nots? Or does it exclude some of the repetitions of it? Because some of them are given repeatedly. But it is the words of the law. Does that also mean the proclamation of God? You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I would think so. These are going to be large stones set up for writing all of that on there. Does that include the historical parts of the first five books? And I'll go with Dalich, I think not. No, it is the words of the covenant that are most important. So think Genesis 20, 21, 22. Israel is at Mount Sinai, and there are commandments of covenant that are given in those three chapters. And then there are more commandments to come. And they want all of these things to be set up where? Where? Well, verse four.
And when you have crossed over the Jordan, you shall set up these stones concerning which I command you today on Mount Ebal, and you shall plaster them with plaster.
Okay. So it's not Mount Gerizim, it's Mount Ebal. Mount Ebal is where the curses were proclaimed. Mount Gerizim, where the blessings were proclaimed. And why would it be there? Oh, it is a public testimony to stand there for all of Israel and all the nations around them to know of God's blessings. Okay. Ebal, the mountain upon which the curses were to be proclaimed, not Gerizim. Not because the law, not because the curse part of the law speaks more forcefully to sinful man. Not because the curse sounds more credible than the promises, but to show how the law and the economy of the Old Testament would would pronounce the curse which rests upon the whole human race because of sin and awaken a desire for the Messiah who was to take away the curse and bring the true blessing instead. So, could you say Mount Ebal was the Old Testament mountain and Mount Gerizim the New Testament mountain? I think that would be pushing a little far, but there is a pointing to the promises and the Messiah. Okay, so that was verse 4. Verse 5, and there you shall build an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall wield no iron tool on them. Verse 6.
Build the altar of the Lord your God with field stones and offer burnt offerings on it to the Lord your God.
So these are uncut, unhewn, undressed stones. Natural, because this altar is to be made from what God has provided in nature. No work of man is involved. Simply the bringing them together.
I'm wondering if when they wrote on the stones, did they use an ink or did they cut the stones? It's just a curious question.
There is an answer to that.
There is, okay.
Yep, in two verses. I'll give you the answer. And you shall sacrifice peace offerings and shall eat there, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God. Okay, verse 8.
And you shall write on the stones all the words of this law very plainly.
Okay, so it's not to be carved into the stone. And Dalich says, nor is it to be carved into the plaster. but it is to be painted on the stones. That might require redoing it every so often, but then again, if it is plaster and there's lime and there's all of that, the whatever they use to write it with could sink into the layers of plastering. Okay, verse 9. Then Moses and the Levitical priest said to all Israel, "Keep silence and hear, O Israel. This day you have become the people of the Lord your God." This is a re-consecrating, re-putting in place of the covenant relationship. Verse 10.
Obey the Lord your God and follow his commands and decrees that I give you today.
Mm-hmm. That day Moses charged the people, saying, verse 12.
When you have crossed the Jordan, these tribes shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people: Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin.
Mm-hmm. And these shall stand on Mount Ebal for the curse: Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali. By the way,
all northern tribes.
No. The ones on Mount Gerizim with the blessing are all tribes of the wives. Those on Mount Ebal, four of them are tribes of the servants of Leah and Rachel. There is two of the children of the wives included in that.
Reuben.
Yeah. One named before the tribes of the servant of Leah, and one named before the tribes of the servant of Rachel. And I think that's Reuben and Zebulun, if I'm not missing my memory of this. To even out 6 and 6. Verse 14. Verse 14.
The Levites shall recite to all the people of Israel in a loud voice.
Okay. Back to Dalich, who paints this up with the 6 tribes on Ebal, the 6 tribes on Gerizim, and the Levites. Oh, Reuben was the firstborn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of Leah. Zebulun was the youngest of Leah. And the Israelites took their stand in the center between the two mountains with the Ark of the Covenant. The people took up their position on both sides opposite to the Ark. And the priests who stood in the middle pronounced the different formularies of blessings and cursing, to which the 6 tribes answered, "Amen." And the people of Israel were to be present in the persons of all their adult men who were over 20 years of age. Verses 15 to 26 tally 12 curses, one for each tribe, because these are the warnings. We'll read a couple, and we'll leave off for today. And next week, we'll cover the rest of these and then get into chapter 28, the blessings and curses.
And so, then the week after that.
So we'll verse 15. Cursed be the man who makes a carved or cast metal image, an abomination to the Lord, a thing made by the hands of a craftsman, and sets it up in secret. And all the people shall answer and say, Amen. Okay. Verse 16.
Cursed be anyone who dishonors his father or his mother, and all the people shall say, Amen.
Okay, so you have relationship with God, relationship with parents. First table of the law, second table of the law. Cursed be anyone who moves his neighbor's landmark, and all the people shall say, Amen. And so this is in relationship with the land which God has given. So God and the people and the land. It's a very common, very common formulary there.